Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It has been almost 2 years since Supreme Court conservatives overturned Roe. Abortion is now banned in 14 states and heavily restricted in another 7. The effects have been profound. 64,000 pregnancies caused by rape between July 1st, 2022 and January 1st, 2024 have occurred in states with total abortion bans, according to a study published in the JAMA Network in January. The authors estimate more than 26,000 rape-caused pregnancies may have taken place in Texas alone. Because of extreme abortion bans, more than 171,000 patients have been forced to travel across state lines to get an abortion last year, according to the Guttmacher Institute. The reason why we are not hearing about deaths due to dangerous back alley abortions is because of medication abortion, which now account for 63% of all abortions. The majority of medication abortions use the drug mifepristone, which was first approved by the FDA in 2000 and is highly safe and effective. Last week, the Supreme Court unanimously rejected a bid by anti-abortion groups to roll back access to mifepristone. While the ruling keeps medication abortion legal for now, abortion advocates and providers say the fight is far from over. Joining us to discuss the case and abortion 2 years after Roe was overturned are two guests. Rabia Mukaddam is senior staff attorney at the Center for Reproductive Rights, an organization that uses the power of law to advance reproductive rights as fundamental human rights around the world. Hi, Rabia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Thank you.
We're also joined by Carrie Baker, professor of American Studies and chair of the program for the study of women and gender at Smith College and author of the forthcoming book, Abortion Pills, U.S. History and Politics. In a recent piece for Slate, Professor Baker wrote about how the failed attempt by the Christian right to limit medication abortion may have inadvertently made more women aware that it was an option. She writes, quote, "The more anti-abortion activists attacked mifepristone, the more women flocked to use it," end quote. Hi, Carrie. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have both of you. I just wonder what really stands out for you both as you look back over the course of 2 years since Roe was overturned. Rabia, let's start with you.
I think one of the things that stands out to me so strongly is that in that decision, Justice Alito asserted that this was some sort of resolution to the issue of abortion in the federal courts, as if Dobbs would put to rest an issue that had, you know, plagued jurists. And what we knew is that Dobbs was going to be an unleashing. It was going to be an empowering. And what happened is that anti-abortion extremists around the country knew that they had an ear at the highest levels of the law. And as a result, this did not resolve anything. It just encouraged anti-abortion extremists to take more and more fringe theories. And frankly, we're seeing them succeed in many cases. The Alliance case is an example of such a fringe legal idea that made it all the way to the Supreme Court. So I think that's one of the things that I see that is just continues to astound me.
Can you elaborate on this particular case and why it was a fringe idea for listeners who might not know about the details?
Sure. So in the Alliance case, the anti-abortion doctors and associations were asserting at a high level that other people prescribing mifepristone to other people in states where mifepristone is legal under regulations that expanded access to the drug somehow caused downstream effects that harmed those individual doctors. And the primary harm they identified was having to care for patients with so-called complications. And those complications were somehow increased by the FDA's regulations. So if that sounds like a lot of steps, that's right. It's an incredibly attenuated chain. And what became apparent is that none of the doctors who actually wrote declarations in the case had ever actually had to treat a mifepristone complication against their wishes. So the idea that these plaintiffs could challenge the FDA's regulations is really unhinged. And then you add to that the idea that the FDA acted unlawfully in approving and expanding access to a drug that is one of the best studied medications on the market. It has been repeatedly shown to be as safe as Advil and Tylenol, highly effective. So both the theory of why these plaintiffs could challenge the FDA and the actual argument about the FDA action is so far outside of the legal mainstream, it should never have made it past the trial court. But in this post-Roe world, we're seeing these really just beyond the pale legal theories making it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And that's deeply shocking.
Carrie, what about you? What really stands out for you when you look at the last 2 years after Roe was overturned?
Well, I guess there's a lot of things, but one that I would bring up is that there are more abortions today than there were 10 years ago. We broken through 1 million reported abortions from doctors, which that's way up. And in other words, I think that overturning Roe has created an abortion revolution in this country. And let me explain what I mean by that. Before Roe was overturned, many people did not have access to abortion because it was tightly controlled by doctors and states, even progressive states, have all sorts of restrictions about how to access abortion. And what happened as a result of the pandemic and the overturning of Dobbs is that a lot of the progressive states really expanded access. And then, of course, a bunch of states banned it. But the FDA, for the first time, allowed telemedicine abortion, which means that people could order abortion pills over the phone or by video conference from a doctor in not just in their own state, but from another state. And so I think that all of that has really contributed to increasing number of abortions. Today, we now have, as Rabia mentioned, 2/3 of abortions are done with pills and 1/5 of abortions are done with telemedicine. Well, in 2020, zero abortions were done with telemedicine and it was about 50% done with pills. So I think that what has happened is that there's been a real awakening that abortion has been restricted and stigmatized for years and that it doesn't have to be that way. Abortion pills are safer than Tylenol and they're very accessible. You can order them online. You can order them by telemedicine. You shouldn't have to go to a clinic that may be hundreds of miles away or cross protester lines or pay $500 to $700, which is what they cost on average if you go to in person into a clinic. That in fact, you could pay $150 through telemedicine, get it in 2 days and be done with it. And so more and more people are accessing pills, both within the medical system and outside of the medical system. Since Dobbs, we've developed a robust system to get pills to people outside of the medical system. So all of that, I think, has been really transformational for how people are getting abortions and how many people are actually accessing care despite the bans.
Carrie, this is such an important point because this is the reason, like I said in the intro, that we're not hearing of deaths like we did pre-Roe.
Yes.
Due to dangerous back alley abortions. We're not seeing the signs with the coat hangers because of medication abortion.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I must say, we are seeing deaths. But and like harm to women's health, but not because of abortion. It's because women who are carrying pregnancies to term, wanted pregnancies, have complications and then can't get medical care in those states that you mentioned because the exceptions to their bans are so narrow, you have to be on the brink of death. And so that has been really horrific, but it hasn't been women seeking elective abortions that have been having that kind of trouble.
Rabia, the Center for Reproductive Rights and its partners submitted an amicus brief in the case, the Supreme Court case, in support of the FDA's actions to expand access to mifepristone. So for the reasons that you laid out, the Supreme Court unanimously rejected this bid And a number of lawyers and advocates and clinic workers say, okay, this is a victory for now for abortion advocates. But the anti-choice side and the lawyers are going to come back for this. So can you explain what their method might be and how are you all preparing?
Sure. Yes, it's definitely, this battle is not over. For one, and three states have been allowed to intervene in the trial court in the Alliance case. To be clear, if the existing plaintiffs did not have standing, that means that the trial court never had jurisdiction. And so the entire case should be dismissed, including the three states. But unfortunately, this case has often reflected that the lower courts don't always follow the rules. So it's possible that those three states could try to keep the case going. And they are asserting a slightly different argument as to why they have standing to bring their case. But even if the entire case is dismissed, we understand that other states may be interested in filing similar suits. So I don't think we have seen the last of challenges to FDA's regulation of mifepristone. And also, this is just one tool in the anti-abortion extremists' attack on medication abortion. Louisiana just passed a law trying to make mifepristone a controlled substance. We are seeing strategies laid out in the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 wish list for a future hostile administration that includes things like weaponizing the Comstock laws. They're going to come for medication abortion. And like Barry said, they're doing it because medication abortion has been a lifeline for people in the post-Roe world. Safe, effective, easy to use, provides extra privacy, lots of reasons why people prefer it. So I think we are in the process of seeing how additional attacks will unfold. What we're doing is continuing to prepare to counter those efforts, including by, you know, litigating our case. And we have a case in the Western District of Virginia to try and preserve access to mifepristone should additional threats arise. We are working on advocacy at the state and federal level to try and counter these threats, but they're certainly not over.
You mentioned the three states. So attorneys general in Idaho, Kansas, and Missouri say that they are going to keep litigating the case at the district level. Missouri Attorney General Andrew Bailey posted a statement on Thursday in response to the Supreme Court's decision. He said today's ruling only applies to standing. The court did not reach the merits. My case is still alive at the district court. So can you tell us what does that mean exactly?
Well, it's definitely wrong. if the lower court never had jurisdiction, which is basically what the Supreme Court held, then the judge never properly admitted the three states to the case in the first place. So whether or not the Supreme Court ruled on the merits of the questions is actually irrelevant to whether the case should be dismissed in full. However, I think the reality is that these actors don't care about the ordinary course of the law. And often neither do the lower courts. So they may be allowed to continue their case, even though that's not what the law dictates. As to whether or not the FDA actions were likely unlawful, that is still not something that the court should reach with the states as plaintiffs. One of the things the court identified was that these plaintiffs are not regulated by the FDA. They are not the people on whom these regulations act. And that is as true for the states as it is for the anti-abortion doctors and associations. These are people trying to challenge other people's prescription of a drug to other people. So plaintiffs like that, whether they're the states or the other parties, have to reach a much higher level of burden in demonstrating that they can challenge a particular regulation. So the reasoning of the decision, I think, should also discourage the trial court from allowing these states to proceed. But we've just seen over and over that the lower courts just kind of push the ordinary course to the wayside and do whatever they feel like. So we are definitely worried that those states will continue the case in some form, even though it really should not be appropriate under the law.
Rabia Mukadam is senior staff attorney at the Center for Reproductive Rights. The center and its partners submitted an amicus brief in the case in support of the FDA's actions to expand access to mifepristone. The brief highlighted how lower court rulings in the case relied on, quote, patently unreliable witnesses and ideologically tainted junk science. We're also joined by Carrie Baker, professor of American Studies and chair of the Program for the Study of Women and Gender at Smith College and author of the forthcoming book, Abortion Pills, U.S. History and Politics. If you have any questions or comments for our guests about today's show, we're talking about where we are right now, 2 years. I can't believe it's been 2 years since Supreme Court conservatives overturned Roe. Abortion is now banned in 14 states and heavily restricted in another 7. Medication abortion accounts for 63% of all abortions today. The majority of medication abortions use the drug mifepristone. And we're talking about the recent Supreme Court unanimous ruling rejecting a bid by anti-abortion groups to roll back access to mifepristone. Abortion advocates and providers say this fight is far from over. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. For people who have not been following this closely, I think they might be surprised to learn about the fact that medication abortion accounts for 63% of all abortions now. And Carrie, in the piece that you wrote for Slate, you write, the ultimate effect might be quite positive for abortion access. Thanks to media coverage and advocacy around this case, more women are aware that medication abortion is an option. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So like I mentioned before, the uptake on medication abortion has been very slow over the 24 years since it was originally adopted or approved by the FDA. And that was in part because of the tight restrictions the FDA put on the medication, but also medical providers in many cases preferred to just do procedural abortions rather than medication because it takes a little longer and they have less control. And so in my book about the history of abortion pills, I sort of trace this resistance. And so a lot of people didn't know about the existence of abortion pills and, you know, weren't given information to really make that decision. And, you know, if they had to go to clinics anyway, it was just as easy to get a procedure rather than getting the medication. But once telemedicine became available, first during the pandemic and then permanently in December of 2021, all these virtual clinics popped up. And, you know, then it was a matter of how do you get the word out that this exists and that it's so safe and accessible. And the argument I make in my Slate piece is that this Supreme Court abortion pill case, while it was a terrible case and the anti-abortion people who filed it were trying to spread misinformation that abortion pills were dangerous. In fact, massive media coverage, you know, sort of dug in and showed just how safe this pill was. And an example of that is the New York Times published an article documenting over 100 studies showing just how safe and effective abortion pills were. And that was one of many, many articles across the country. And so I think that people began, you know, I didn't know you could have an abortion by a pill. And then once they realized they could just go on their phones and order these pills very easily and get them very quickly, it became more and more prevalent. And like I say, 1 in 5 abortions now done by clinical providers is done by telemedicine. And then there's many, many more outside of the medical system. People are getting abortion pills through community networks, which are providing these pills for free, and also ordering them from websites. There's a wonderful organization called PlanCPills.org, which vets websites selling pills and then lists what they charge, how long it takes, what kind of forms of payment they take. And you can now get abortion pills for $28 with 2 to 5 day delivery. And, you know, people order pills all the time, you know, online because our pharmaceuticals are so expensive. And, you know, Plan C vets these pills. They take them to laboratories, get them tested, make sure they're high quality medications. They're not FDA approved pills, but they're you know, this is a workaround. It's not ideal, but tens of thousands of people are doing this. And so I think that it is really spreading word about pills and making people realize abortion doesn't have to be difficult to access. It can be easy to access. And that, I think, is really making a tremendous difference.
Rabia, this is making me think about the guest we've had on many times, Robin Marty, who is director of operations for the West Alabama Women's Center. And we've had her on so many times, and she has said, while it's important to talk about states like California that are opening new clinics and even putting up money to ensure that people who need to travel to California have those funds, she said, this is just not possible for the poor people she works with in Alabama. She says, I do not want people to forget about the poor people, especially in the South, who do not have funds. They don't have the time to travel. And I think about this all the time. So hearing Carrie talk about efforts to get this information out to people about the pill, it just makes you think about those poor people who cannot travel. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think this is one thing that has been missing a bit from at least the sort of public sense of what's happening post Roe. And it's very similar to what was happening pre-Dobbs, although it's much worse now, which is that people of color, rural people, low-income people, young people, people who already face just huge barriers to healthcare access generally, were already unable to get abortion, even under Roe, for a long time. And I think the experience of clinics in those states has just shown how dramatic the barriers are to getting access to reproductive health care, period, but also abortion. And these are also people who are left out a bit thus far from a lot of the advances in telemedicine. Some of the data suggests that people are expanding access to mifepristone through these innovative models, but a lot of there are very low percentages of people of color among those patients. And a lot of it is the barrier to information and resources that is so endemic in the Deep South. So I think one of the things that I hope to see, and I think many people are already invested in making this happen, including organizations like Plan C that Carrie mentioned, is how to get information and community and practical support to people who have long been left out of the sort of traditional ways of getting people access to this medication. And I have a lot of hope that we're moving in the right direction, but it has always been that restrictions on abortion fall hardest on the people who lack access to healthcare generally, who are the most vulnerable in our society. And it's one of the most frustrating things about the Supreme Court's sort of myopic decision in Dobbs, which is, you know, not only is abortion essential to people's autonomy, but there are particular people who will suffer just extraordinary consequences from that autonomy being withheld. And those people are exactly the people that West Alabama Women's Center and those clinics used to see all the time.
Right. Rubia, before we let you go, what else concerns you at this point? I mean, what other legal cases do you think will be coming in the future? I was just reading in the Texas Tribune last month, they had a piece, and this is by Jamie Lozano Carvo. It says, the city council of Clarendon, a rural panhandle town, rejected a proposed ordinance seeking to prohibit traveling through city limits to get an abortion in another state. The 3-0 decision makes Clarendon one of the first cities in Texas to reject an abortion travel ban, as more conservative cities are approving similar measures. So how in the heck is this supposed to work? These conservative cities are now going to prohibit people from crossing city or state lines to get an abortion?
Honestly, maybe. These ordinances are being considered all across the South. One was actually just rejected by the city of Amarillo, which is, frankly, a borderline miracle. But the suggestion has been, let's block the roads. Let's have checkpoints. Let's treat people like criminals in their own communities. It's deeply frightening. And the laws we've seen at the state level in this vein are these atrocious bills that are basically designed to prevent young people from accessing community support in getting abortions out of state. So the other side calls these abortion trafficking bills, as if it's some sort of, you know, kidnapping. But what it does is it prevents young people and young people without parental support from accessing care out of state. So we are seeing some really dangerous ideas here percolating about how to stop people from getting abortions, even outside of states where abortion is banned. And that's disturbing on a number of levels. And it's also unconstitutional on a number of levels. But that doesn't mean that they won't succeed to some degree, as we've seen. This is a time when the anti-abortion extremists feel that they are in ascendancy and they are not holding back.
And another case that we're expecting soon coming out of the Supreme Court is whether hospitals will be required to provide abortions in emergency situations.
Yeah, the Emtala case is just an example of truly how anti-abortion extremists have no care for people and their health. This is not about banning abortion that they call elective. This is about banning abortion of every kind, in every place, for everyone, whether or not you are on death's door. And one thing that was apparent at argument in that case is just the absolute disregard for the health of pregnant people. And Idaho thinks they're disposable, and it thinks that Supreme Court will agree. And honestly, they may.
Wow. Well, that one did not come down today. It could be coming down tomorrow or next week. Rabia Mukaddam is senior staff attorney at the Center for Reproductive Rights. They submitted an amicus brief in the case in support of the FDA's actions to expand access to mifepristone. Rabia, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we'll continue our discussion about abortion 2 years after conservatives on the Supreme Court overturned Roe, with Carrie Baker, professor of American Studies and chair of the program for the study of women and gender at Smith College, and author of the forthcoming book, Abortion Pills, U.S. History and Politics. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. On tomorrow's Media Roundtable, we will discuss the plight of journalists in Gaza. At least 108 journalists and media workers have been killed by Israeli strikes, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. We will also discuss, and this is related to today's show, coverage of Supreme Court rulings and recent headlines about Justices Alito and Thomas. If you'd like to join today's show about what has happened since Roe was overturned by Supreme Court conservatives almost 2 years ago, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Carrie Baker is professor of American Studies and chair of the program for the study of women and gender at Smith College, and author of the forthcoming book, Abortion Pills, U.S. History and Politics. And now we'd like to welcome back Jessica Mason Piclo, senior vice president and executive editor of the Rewire News Group, co-author of the book, The End of Roe v. Wade, Inside the Right's Plan to Destroy Legal Abortion, and co-host of the podcast, Boom Lawyered. Hi, Jessica. Thanks for joining us again.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back.
Well, Jessica, it's a big question, but I just wonder, given that you follow what's going on across the country so closely, what really stands out for you when you look back at the past 2 years after Roe was overturned?
Oh, wow. What a question. I think one of the things that really stands out to me is how quickly the anti-choice movement jumped on its most extreme policy positions and mainstreamed them, so that we are 2 years after Dobbs and we have a sea change, for example, in the way the conservative movement is publicly talking about IVF and fertility enhancement. We have a sea change in the way that they are talking about contraception. And, you know, the segment before had mentioned some of these, you know, travel bans and extreme bits of legislation that we're seeing crop up in states and municipalities. We're also seeing litigation used and weaponized in new ways. There's, you know, we have a case here in Colorado where a clinic that had provided an abortion to an out-of-state patient from Texas is potentially, Jonathan Mitchell is trying to potentially subpoena records around that. So one of the things that Dobbs has done is really upended our traditional understandings of the relationship between state, federal, local governments in our bodies.
Your senior VP and executive editor of the Rewire News Group, this is the only national publication exclusively dedicated to reporting on reproductive and sexual health. What are your thoughts about media coverage of all of these issues, given that, as you say, the extreme right is mainstreaming ideas that I have to say, I have a hard time even saying some of these things. It's shocking that we are here in 2024. What are your thoughts about how major media are covering these issues?
It's hit and miss. I mean, I will say I really appreciate the work that Carrie does in her spaces and with Ms. Magazine. I think their coverage is consistently good. We still see some both sidesing around the issue and reluctance to really take conservatives not just at their word, but follow through with their actions. And again, I will point to the conversation around IVF shortly after the Alabama Supreme Court decision came down. Congressional Republicans came out in the media very loudly and publicly against it, said they supported IVF, and there was no follow-up on that. Had there been follow-up, we would have seen in major media outlets like the New York Times that, in fact, those same Republicans are supporting, co-signing, co-sponsoring legislation at the national level that would functionally allow a Supreme Court decision from the U.S. Supreme Court to nationalize Alabama's decision. Since that Alabama Supreme Court, we now have the Southern Baptist Convention coming out publicly against IVF. We have statements made in the Idaho legislature and in Iowa legislature following up on that. So there has been a policy position, and we're not really seeing a robust conversation around that. You know, so I think that there is still an unwillingness in some outlets to take the very brazen and political nature of what is going on now, in particular after Dobbs, and call it for what it is.
Carrie, what are your thoughts on major media coverage of these issues?
So I would agree with Jess. There's a lot of both sidesism. I find that they're often slow to report on what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. Just let's go back a few years. They didn't believe Roe would be overturned. Yeah. And in the feminist press, we're like, it's happening. It's happening. And they're like, oh, no, it will never happen. And, you know, another example is I've written a lot on crisis pregnancy centers, these anti-abortion mm-hmm. organizations pretending to be reproductive health clinics that mislead and harass women seeking abortion health care. Well, I wrote a piece for the New York Times, and they kept on wanting to put in all these anti-abortion talking points into my guest essay, and I had to fight them tooth and nail to say, these are lies, and I will not have that being put in my article about this issue. They just, you know, again, it's the both sidesism, and they don't see what's happening, and they, I would say, sort of willfully refuse to. I think it's like mm-hmm. the Democratic Party. You know, Biden doesn't want to mention the A word. And it's taken so long to get the Democratic Party to realize that this is an important issue they need to embrace and speak about. Even in the November 2022 elections, they wouldn't organize. They wouldn't talk about this issue. And places like, you know, Feminist Majority and Ms. were saying this is an opportunity to mobilize women voters and young voters and many people, the majority of people support abortion rights. Let's use this. And there was so much resistance. And maybe that's changed a little bit, but even now they're not using this as an election issue as much as they should. And, you know, we've seen 7 ballot initiatives since Dobbs. And they've all gone in the right direction, the sort of abortion rights direction, even in ruby red states like Ohio and Kansas. I mean, in those states where the legislatures are so gerrymandered, they put in these extreme abortion bans, but the population actually supports abortion rights. So if you can get a referendum on the ballot, then people will turn out and vote for it. And so this has been a strategy among feminists and reproductive rights advocates. We've got hopefully as many as 10 ballot initiatives on the November ballot, and that's including in swing states like Arizona and Florida. So there's a lot of mobilization on the ground. Just going back to your initial question about what's been most striking since Dobbs, the mobilization on the ground at multiple levels, politically, legally, you know, in developing this network of accessing pills outside of the medical system has been astounding. And I think it's continuing, and, you know, people care about this issue. This is a, that, like they used to say, a bread and butter issue, but it's really sort of a you know, a life or death issue. And so we just need, you know, I think we need to use that momentum to turn things around. And you know, democracy's on the ballot. Mm-hmm. I think reproductive rights can be a way that we get people out there and doing the right thing in November.
Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Karen in Oakland. Hi, Karen. Thanks for holding.
Hi. I have a comment that I would like to see you, Rose, and your guests and other people who are speaking about abortion use, because there is no such thing as a huge quantity of pregnant people. It's pregnant women and pregnant girls. When I hear pregnant people, it makes me think of people with prostate cancer or people with semen. This is a feminist issue, as your guests had mentioned, but when you talk about pregnant people, it's using politically correct language to take into consideration the 0.00 whatever percent of transgender men who get pregnant whose bodies are still female because they have not had hysterectomies. So please make sure that you use pregnant women and pregnant girls, because this is an issue of misogyny, this anti-abortion.
Well, thank you for that, Karen. You're reminding me of a piece Ellie Mistal of The Nation wrote about this, and he brought up some of the issues you raise, and he said, can we say pregnant women, girls, and people who can get pregnant? And he said, can we just put this to rest? Because let's talk about the issue at hand. Carrie or Jessica, anything to add there? Any response?
Well, I agree with the caller that we have degendered reproductive health care by using the language of people, and that's, I think, strategically unwise because it is a gendered issue. Abortion bans are based in misogyny. We cannot erase the fact that it is women who are being targeted and LGBTQ people. And so within the healthcare context, I think inclusive language is really important because you want to make all patients feel welcome and be able to access care. But I think when you're talking politically and legislatively, it's really important to frame this issue as a sex discrimination issue. In Dobbs, Alito said that it was not sex discrimination. Alito said it was not sex discrimination, and he cited a 1970s decision having to do with pregnancy discrimination, and he said pregnancy discrimination isn't sex discrimination because it doesn't discriminate against women, it discriminates against pregnant people. And we on the left have adopted that language from that 1970s decision, and I think that it really, by using gender-neutral language in every context, it obscures the gendered and misogynist basis of abortion bans. And so I think we need to be more nuanced in our language and make sure that we don't obscure that misogyny.
Well, I'm afraid that we forget about girls. And I think every time I think about this, I think about the Time Magazine piece by Charlotte Alter. She wasn't able to get an abortion. Now she's a mom. Soon she will start the seventh grade. She's 13 years old. And we know that girls younger than 13 have been raped and have been pregnant. And I remember when this piece came out, a lot of people said, wait a minute, you can get pregnant when you're 13? Which just shows how little people know about these issues. And I wonder, again, Carrie or Jessica, we talk about all of these statistics that are coming out and these numbers, and they're so important. For example, from Guttmacher, 171,000 women, girls, and people were forced to travel across state lines to get an abortion last year. 64,000 pregnancies were caused by rape between July 2022, January 2024. They occurred in states with total abortion bans. Now, we're hearing from so many brave women who wanted to be moms. They found out that their fetus had some sort of fetal anomaly and they had to travel out of state. Very brave people coming forward. But I keep thinking about the people we're not hearing about. What about the moms who are pregnant and can't get an abortion, or the young women who were raped, or the girls who can't get an abortion and are forced to have a child? Is there any way to know, Jessica, how many people we're talking about here? I don't even know how we would come up with these numbers.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's such an excellent point. And so there are demographers and folks who are researchers who look at and try to count and capture in the Turnaway study just that situation that you're talking about. You know, what happens to the folks who are turned away from care? One of the consequences of post-Dobbs, though, is that folks are even more nervous of reporting around reproductive health outcomes in general. And so the question of are we able to capture and count correctly is one that I know my colleagues on the research side are working on and have, you know, sort of reported feeling the weight of that. And I think, you know, another area that we will start to see this bleed into, and it existed before Dobbs, but it was amplified after Dobbs, is the crossover with folks who then end up in the carceral state where law enforcement is involved. You know, one of the things that abortion bans do is create a legal presumption that a failed pregnancy is a potential crime. And so there is, in fact, I will be speaking at a conference of forensic nurses here in Denver in August, because there is a lot of concern around frontline medical professionals about mandatory reporting requirements, law enforcement involvement, and basically how they manage those spaces with pregnancy now. And it is, we're in some really dark and scary times.
Wow. Carrie, what would you add?
Well, yeah, it's a very hard number to get at. I mean, I just would go back to the point I made at the beginning of the show, which is that there are more abortions now. People have more access to abortion overall. That said, obviously in the banned states, they have less access. And if you're talking about young people, poor people, people of color disproportionately don't have access to that care. And I think this is why we need to do more to get medications out. I'll just give one example. I talked to one of these community networks, which distributes pills for free within states that have bans. And when I interviewed her, she said that the reason she started doing that, and this was in 2019, long before Dobbs, was because she worked in an abortion fund and I think it was like a 15-year-old girl called her from rural southern state and said, there's just no way I can travel to get care. And what this woman did is that she went and got pills and mailed them to this girl. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, so this has been happening for a long time. And I think that, again, this sort of revolutionary change in access to abortion pills can be transformational in getting care to people that previously weren't able to access care. And then again, the question is just how do we get the word out to people? But I think that the more people that learn about this and experience this, and then they tell other people, you know, call me an optimist, but I think that this has been a problem for a long time, but now we have solutions within arm's reach, and it's a matter of getting the word out. And, you know, and by the way, countries around the world that ban abortion have been using abortion pills outside of the medical system for years. And, you know, maternal mortality rates dropped precipitously once pills became available. And, you know, unfortunately, that's what we're having to do here. We're having to create our own underground networks to get pills to people, particularly the most marginalized. And by the way, I will say, like, immigrant communities have been using pills outside the medical system for years, getting them through their own networks at flea markets or even through pharmacies. So, you know, I think a lot is happening that's, you know, going back to thinking about mainstream media, there's very little coverage of, and maybe that's good at one level, but it's really transforming abortion access in the United States.
And we know that in southern states, fewer physicians are learning how to provide surgical abortions, well, because for obvious reasons, it's banned. And I just wonder how you think that's going to affect the landscape. I mean, given that abortion is nearly banned in almost half of the country. What are your thoughts on this, Carrie? Do you think that in these places, nearly all abortions will be performed using medication?
No, absolutely not. Because if somebody's in their 20th week and they have a medical complication, they need access to a medical provider. And so what worries me most, again, is not people seeking elective abortions, but people seeking medically necessary abortions. And if, like, I think about Idaho, a matter of fact, not even just people seeking abortions for medical reasons, people giving birth. It's OBGYNs who are leaving those states. We are seeing the proliferation of maternal care deserts in states like Idaho and Louisiana and Mississippi, because doctors do not want to practice in states that don't allow them to practice good medicine, that don't allow them to treat patients who are in critical situations. So I, again, as I have said, I'm always much more worried about the health of women bringing pregnancies to term, because I think they're the ones whose lives and health are on the line. And, you know, I think that eventually, and call me an optimist, this boat's going to turn around because of this, but it may take a while, and a lot of people are going to suffer in the meantime.
Can you both, we have about 5 minutes left. Can you both talk about, I mean, this is another big question, Carrie, but since you brought up the Democrats and how they've really failed to discuss this issue, they failed on many aspects of this issue. We'll have to do another show about this, but given all the work that you've done, what are your thoughts about why they have failed, and where do you think they are going now that this is happening, where you've got abortion banned in almost half the country? Carrie?
You want me to talk about that?
Yes,
yeah,
please.
So, I mean, I do think that slowly they're starting to get the memo that this is an issue that's helpful. I think it's happening more at the state level. I think about, for instance, Governor Gavin Newsom in California, who's been doing a lot of really aggressive advertising around abortion access and California as a place where people can access care. I think at the national level, I mean, again, I still haven't seen enough of a focus on this issue. You know, I will say that within the last 2 weeks, Democrats have forced votes on the Right to Contraception Act and the Right to IVF Act in the Senate. And all but two Republican senators voted in favor of these two very popular pieces of legislation. IVF is favored by 86% of the population. Contraception is favored by 81% of the population. And these Republicans are voting against it. And so what Democrats want to do is go to the states now where these senators are from and use those no votes on these very popular reproductive health issues to try to win those seats. And so, you know, this is not talking about abortion. It's talking about IVF and contraception, which I think are easier issues for the mainstream Democratic Party to get on board with. I think it can potentially be a really effective strategy because, again, particularly women, they don't want to have a representative who wants to ban contraception. Mm. So, you know, I think that's really where the sort of weight is going. I will say, though, today, Senator Tina Smith introduced a bill to reverse the Comstock Act. And so I don't know that they're going to get that to the floor. I don't know, you know, the degree to which Democrats are going to get behind that. But that's the law that the abortion pill Supreme Court case was brought under to try to ban abortion pills nationwide. It's a misuse of that 19th century anti-obscenity law, but it is, you know, what they're doing. And so Tina Smith introduced this to try to just reverse this law so they can't go to the court and try to get abortion pills banned.
Hmm. And Jessica, in our remaining 2 minutes, can you talk more about the Republican Party's end game here? What happens if they take back the White House?
Absolutely. Well, they've told us exactly what happens if they take back the White House via Project 2025. The Republican Party is right now on this issue controlled by what used to be the most extreme wing of the anti-choice movement and is now more mainstream. They are looking for fetal personhood, a ruling that would create effectively life, a ruling that says life begins at conception. It's a reworking and a rewriting of the 14th Amendment. We saw some of these arguments bubble up a little bit in the Emtala case. And that is, we see it all around the conversation conversation around IVF. We see it the ways in which conservatives try to talk about some forms of hormonal contraception as abortifacients and blur those lines. So that is really truly what they're going for. And just to add on to Carrie's point with the Democrats, you know, I think we are seeing the result of the Democratic Party see itself as a big tent policy that could accommodate anti-choice views for a long time. And most of the particularly national senators on this issue are just not great on it because they haven't had any practice being good on it. They have sort of gotten it in their head that they need to accommodate anti-choice beliefs. And we are at a place where that is just not possible. This is a human rights crisis that we're in as a result of the Dobbs decision.
Jessica Mason Piclo is Senior Vice President and Executive Editor of the Rewire News Group, co-host of the podcast Boom Lawyered, and co-author of The End of Roe v. Wade, Inside the Rights Plan to Destroy Legal Abortion. Carrie Baker is Professor of American Studies and Chair of the Program for the Study of Women and Gender at Smith College and author of the forthcoming book, Abortion Pills, U.S. History and Politics. Jessica and Carrie, thank you for your work and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rose.
Thank you. And you can find more about Jessica and Carrie's work at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Savannah Harriman-Pote for producing today's show. Thanks to Tariq Ansari for engineering our show. We hope you can join us tomorrow. It's our media roundtable. We'll discuss the plight of journalists in Gaza. At least 108 journalists and media workers have been killed by Israeli strikes, making it the deadliest period for journalists since the Committee to Protect Journalists began gathering data in 1992. Then we'll discuss coverage of Supreme Court rulings and recent headlines about Justices Alito and Thomas. We hope you can join us tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, email yourcall@kalw.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.